these sorts of things. And as far as my soy consumption, I like edamame. And a lot of restaurants use blended vegetable oils to cook your food, which have some soy. In particular, it's the places like Chili's and Applebee's and places like that. So I don't go to those places. So it's completely conceivable that this caller's soy consumption is significantly superior to mine. But edamame, love edamame, miso. I do a beautiful miso salmon. Miso, of course, from fermented soybeans. But I don't know. I don't really think about soy, and it's not a big part of my diet. But I'm glad to look into it further if you need me to, sir. We have a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about eclipse tourism and conspiracies and traffic chaos. We will talk about Tesla in an act of desperation, offering 30 days of full self-driving to everybody. I got it. I'll tell you my experience with it. And Joe Biden announcing, yes, even more student loan debt relief. Even more student loan debt relief. All of those stories on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get any or all three of the children's books at davidpacman.com/book. Everybody, welcome to the David Pakman Show. I'm producer Pat Ford filling in for David today as he is traveling, but fear not, he's going to be back with us on Monday. Donald Trump suffered three legal defeats in courts all across the country this week. Let's dive right into it because he is not having a great time when it comes to these criminal trials. Former President Donald Trump encountered significant legal setbacks this week, having to do with three out of his four criminal cases. Two were over attempts to dismiss criminal charges outright, and one was over an attempt to delay the trial. Turns out he lost all three motions. Let's start first with the New York hush money trial. Judge Juan Merchan dismissed Trump's motion to delay the New York hush money trial, scheduled to start in just a couple weeks from now, April 15th. Trump's legal team had sought to postpone the trial until the Supreme Court ruled on the claim of presidential immunity that he is using in his federal 2020 election case. That's actually succeeded in delaying that case, at least for now, until the Supreme Court hears this immunity argument. So the idea from Trump's lawyers when it came to this New York case was maybe we can get this one delayed as well. And of course, if you're Trump, you want to delay as much as possible, delay it until at least the 2024 election and beyond. And then with some of these federal cases, at least you have the chance of being able to pardon yourself if you're found guilty. So Trump's lawyers were trying to test their luck, but Juan Merchan stepped in and rejected the motion as untimely, emphasizing that they missed their opportunities to file such a motion to take legal action like this. So once again, this comes down to poor legal work from Donald Trump's defense team. If they had put in this argument earlier, maybe Judge Merchan would have been more amenable to it. Merchan wrote, "This court finds that defendant had myriad opportunities to raise the claim of presidential immunity well before March 7, 2024. After all, defendant had already briefed the same issue in federal court, and he was in possession of and aware that the people intended to offer the relevant evidence at trial that entire time. The circumstances viewed as a whole test this court's credulity." The trial centers, of course, on hush money payments made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential campaign, effectively making it an in-kind campaign contribution that went well beyond the limits. Trump has pleaded not guilty to the charges, and once again, it's slated to start very soon on April 15th. Now let's go to the Georgia election interference case. Judge Scott McAfee this week denied Trump's attempt to dismiss the Georgia election interference case. Trump and his many co-defendants argued that the indictment infringed on their First Amendment rights, specifically free speech rights. But McAfee clarified that political speech does not shield criminal activity from prosecution, emphasizing intent over truthfulness. Of course, this was always a ridiculous argument to make, because if you use your speech to commit a crime, well, then it's no longer free speech. Just like if you say to your friend, "Hey, go kill this person for me," that speech is not protected. And yes, you can be prosecuted for doing that, rightfully so. the judge in the case wrote, even core political speech addressing matters of public concern is not impenetrable from prosecution if allegedly used to further criminal activity. Now, the defendants claimed that Donald Trump was just using political speech, like when, for example, he called up Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and asked him to find the 11,280 votes. That was just political speech, according to them. And so Donald Trump can't be prosecuted for making false political.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and...
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The sad reality of what's happening in Gaza right now actually eclipses, I would argue, any sort of even comparative humanitarian crisis that we've seen.
As Israel's assault on Gaza stretches into its seventh month, we'll be joined by Arwa Damon. She's just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza yesterday. An award-winning journalist, now the founder of Inara, a nonprofit providing medical and mental health care to children. Then Rwanda marks the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor.
It's not easy for people going through genocide to be that strong, but we're there, we're doing our best to make sure that the past never repeats itself.
As up to 1 million Rwandans were killed, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refusing to stop the slaughter. We'll speak with former Human Rights Watch Executive Director Ken Roth about the role of Western nations in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide and their role in Israel's assault on Gaza, which the UN's top court says is a plausible case of genocide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian media say airstrikes hit two homes in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood earlier today, killing and injuring dozens of people. Other attacks were reported in other Gaza City neighborhoods, including Shujaya and Sabra. This comes as negotiations in Egypt continue. Hamas says the latest ceasefire proposal does not meet its demands, but that it's continuing to review the plan, which includes a six-week pause in fighting and the exchange of 40 Israeli hostages for at least 700 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. While Hamas is demanding Israel end its assault on Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Monday that Israel has set a date to invade Rafah.
Today, I received a report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals. First and foremost, the release of all of our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. The victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Displaced Palestinians have been returning to Khan Yunis after Israel withdrew from the decimated southern city. One woman, Ayed al-Najjar, said normally she would be preparing for Eid celebrations at this time of year as she took in the ruins of her home.
Our house was good and had everything. I lacked nothing. I lived happily with my husband, and our daughter's children used to live with us too. There's no Eid for me. I have no desire to celebrate or do anything. I'll just sit in front of my house like this. We won't go anywhere. And many of our family members were martyred. They're still uncovering the bodies. Praise God. Who wants to celebrate? Every house has wounded or martyrs.
The UN Security Council will make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. Palestine initially submitted its application for UN admission in 2011. This is the Palestinian UN ambassador, Riyad Mansour, speaking Monday.
It was a historic moment then, and now that historic moment has been revived again, and we sincerely hope after 12 years since we changed our status to an observer state, that the Security Council will elevate itself to implementing the global consensus on the two-state solution by admitting the State of Palestine for full membership.
But the U.S., one of five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, is expected to use its veto power. U.S. representatives say Palestine needs to negotiate statehood with Israel before it's granted statehood at the U.N. Meanwhile, in The Hague, the International Court of Justice is holding its second day of hearings into Nicaragua's case against Germany. Germany's denied Nicaragua's charge that it violated the Genocide Convention by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Here in the U.S., Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. Warren made the remark as she visited a mosque and was asked by constituents if she believed Israel is committing genocide. Warren said, quote, "If you want to do it as an application of law, I believe that they'll find that it is genocide, and they have ample evidence to do so," she said. Ireland's incoming Prime Minister, Simon Harris, has called for an immediate ceasefire, saying in a speech Sunday the famine in Gaza is a, quote, specter no Irish person can bear, referencing Ireland's historical famines, including the Great Famine of the mid-19th century. Harris, who's being sworn in by Ireland's parliament today, had a message for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, let me say this to you this evening. The Irish people could not be clearer. We are repulsed by your actions. Cease fire now and let the aid flow safely.
Iran's foreign minister opened a new diplomatic site in the Syrian capital, Damascus, Monday, 1 week after Israel bombed the Iranian consulate, killing at least seven Iranian officers. Hossein Amirabdollahian renewed Iran's vow to retaliate and accused the U.S. of giving Israel the green light for the attack.
I want to say from here in Damascus with a loud voice, America is responsible for this terrorist attack, and it must take responsibility.
Meanwhile, Iranian press is reporting Tehran told the Biden administration it'll refrain from attacking Israel if the U.S. can secure a ceasefire in Gaza. The report has not been confirmed by Tehran, and Biden administration has denied it. The University of Michigan's come under fire over its proposed disruptive activity policy, which was issued by the university president, Santa Ono, after Palestinian rights activists interrupted a speech he was giving. The ACLU of Michigan warns the policy will have a chilling effect and likely lead to violations of the First Amendment. Elsewhere, Vanderbilt University in Tennessee has expelled, suspended, and issued disciplinary probations to a group of students who engaged in a sit-in protest demanding Vanderbilt divest from companies complicit in Israel's occupation and killing of Palestinians. Special Counsel Jack Smith is urging the Supreme Court to dismiss Donald Trump's bid for immunity in his federal election interference case, arguing presidents are subject to criminal law. Supreme Court justices are scheduled to hear arguments in the case April 25th. In other Trump news, the GOP frontrunner said Monday abortion rights should be decided by states. Trump has refrained from endorsing a national abortion ban, but has taken credit for the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, which has led to a cascade of abortion bans in Republican-run states, including Florida, where a six-week ban is set to go into effect May 1st. The trial for 27 people charged in connection with the Panama Papers scandal began Monday in Panama City, 8 years after the massive data leak. In 2016, an international team of journalists published millions of documents exposing how the Panama-based Mossack Fonseca law firm set up a global network of shell companies for some of the wealthiest people in the world, heads of state and other elites, to hide money offshore, avoiding taxes and oversight. The leak prompted the resignation of Iceland's prime minister and implicated other world leaders, including former British Prime Minister David Cameron and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Those currently on trial include the founders of the now-defunct Mossack Fonseca law firm. The Panama Papers represent just a fraction of the trillions of dollars hidden away, often illegally, in offshore tax havens. About 100 people were killed, including children, after an overcrowded makeshift ferry sank off the northern coast of Mozambique. Some 20 others are missing. The group of 130 people had fled from Nampula on mainland Mozambique, reportedly after hearing news of a cholera outbreak. Mozambican authorities blamed their deaths on the spread of misinformation about the spread of the disease. President Biden announced new plans to cancel student debt for about 23 million people. Some of those to benefit include borrowers who now owe more than their original loan amount due to out-of-control interest. Those who have had debts for over 20 years, borrowers who were enrolled in so-called low-value school programs, and those facing economic hardship. The new plan would completely erase student debt for around 4 million borrowers. Biden announced the debt relief in a speech in Madison, Wisconsin, Monday, as he made another pitch for re-election in the key swing state.
I also want to make—and I've been pushing this, and if I'm re-elected, I'm going to push it hard. We're going to get it done next time—is I want to make community college tuition free. So you won't need loans at all. We'll cut in half the cost of going to college.
In Strasbourg, France, the European Court of Human Rights handed out one victory and two defeats for the climate justice movement today as it ruled on three historic climate cases. The court ruled in favor of over 2,000 senior women from Switzerland who argued their rights were violated by governmental inaction on the climate crisis.
The court finds that there were some critical lacunae in the Swiss authorities' process of putting in place the relevant domestic regulatory framework. This included a failure to quantify, through a carbon budget or otherwise, national greenhouse gas emissions limitations. Furthermore, as recognized by the relevant authorities, the respondent state had previously failed to meet its past greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. By failing to act in good time and in an appropriate and consistent manner,
the Swiss women hailed their historic victory, but the celebration was tempered by the court's dismissal of similar cases by six youth activists in Portugal and a former French mayor. Activist Greta Thunberg, who was at the courthouse for the verdicts, weighed in on those verdicts.
It's a betrayal beyond words. And today's rulings make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens. It cannot be a political choice whether to respect human rights or not.
And the Brazilian state issued a historic apology for the atrocities committed against indigenous peoples during its military dictatorship. The unprecedented move came as Brazil marked last week the 60th anniversary of the 1964 U.S.-backed coup that ushered in the military dictatorship, which ruled for the next two decades. Brazil's National Truth Commission found 8,300 indigenous people were killed during the dictatorship. Others were thrown off their land, imprisoned in internment camps, and tortured. The apology came after the Guarani, Kiowa, and the Krenak indigenous groups requested a collective apology from the Brazilian government's Amnesty Commission. During a ceremony last Tuesday, the commission's chairwoman, Neia de Stutz, kneeled in front of indigenous leaders to ask for their forgiveness. Here she addresses Janira Krenak.
I'm asking for forgiveness for the persecution that in the last 524 years, your people, as well as all the other original peoples, suffered due to the invasion that the non-indigenous people on this land that belongs to you. So, U.S. leader, as the matriarch of the Krenak people, please bear our respect, our tributes, and our sincere apologies so that this never happens again.
Also last week on Friday, prominent journalist, author, and environmentalist Alton Krenak became the first indigenous member of the prestigious Brazilian Academy of Letters. Krenak vowed to use his seat to open the elite academy to the more than 200 indigenous languages in Brazil. He also reflected on the government's apology issued days earlier, saying, quote, "Saying sorry afterwards means very little in terms of reparation. What we need is real reparations for Native peoples," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak with Arwa Damon, who just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza. The award-winning journalist is now founder of INARA, the International Network for Aid and Relief Assistance, a nonprofit that provides medical and mental health care to children. Stay with us. Sweet Dreams Are Made of This by Eurythmics. Singer Annie Lennox has donated the 1983 handwritten lyrics to be auctioned off to benefit the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israeli warplanes bombed areas across northern Gaza today, while ground troops conducted raids as the assault on the territory entered its 7 months. Forensic experts from Gaza's health ministry are still removing bodies from the yard of Shifa Hospital, once the largest medical facility in Gaza, that was burned down and destroyed by Israeli forces. Health officials say the number of dead following Israel's raid on Shifa is still not known, but is in the hundreds. Meanwhile, in the south, Palestinians who tried to return to Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, following the withdrawal of Israeli troops Sunday, say it is now unlivable. An estimated 55% of the buildings in the Khan Yunis area, around 45,000 buildings, have been destroyed or damaged, according to two mapping experts at City University of New York and Oregon State University, who've been using satellite imagery to track destruction. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has escalated his pledge to invade Rafah, where more than 1.4 million Palestinians, well over half of Gaza's population, are sheltering. In a video statement Monday, Netanyahu said, quote, "It'll happen. There's a date," he said, without elaborating. He spoke as Israeli negotiators were in Cairo discussing international efforts to broker a ceasefire deal with Hamas. The official death toll has now topped 33,300, including over 14,000 children. That number does not include thousands missing under the rubble and presumed dead. Nearly 76,000 people have been wounded. Israel has been accused of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, where the spread of hunger and malnutrition has been described as unprecedented, with famine setting in. For more, we're joined by Arwa Damon. She just returned yesterday from a humanitarian trip to Gaza. She's an award-winning journalist and the founder of INARA, the International Network for Aid, Relief, and Assistance, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Arwa Damon is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She's previously spent 18 years at CNN, including as a senior international correspondent. Arwa Damon joins us now from Istanbul, Turkey. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Arwa. Can you start off by talking about what you saw in Gaza and what you think needs to be done?
You know, on the one hand, that would seem like a simple question. And yet, on the other hand, it's so extraordinarily difficult to actually put what I witnessed into words. In fact, Gazans themselves can't actually grasp the fact that this has become their reality. In Rafah, in this central southern area of Gaza, where you have a crush of about 1.5 million people, it feels as if you're moving through a sea of misery. There is no empty space left. Tents are spilling out of both UN shelters and other makeshift shelters that have emerged. They're spilling out onto the sidewalks. There's stalls that have been set up. The movement of people clogs the streets. You have people having to move around on donkey carts because there's not enough fuel or diesel to power vehicles. And then you just have the sheer need of this entire mass of humanity that is, to a certain degree, feels as if it's absolutely suffocating because they need everything. They are reliant on others for just about everything, from food to water to medicine to baby formula to diapers. We stepped out in this one area called Moasi, which is sort of a beachy area. It was Gaza's beachfront. And there, it's just tent after tent after tent in the sand. There's no sewage systems, and so sewage is sort of running along these makeshift canals. There's no proper toilets. There's no nothing. And all of the mothers there are just shoving these emaciated babies at you, you know, begging for proper formula, begging for proper care. They're begging for medicine for children who are epileptic. You walk into a tent, and with each step your foot takes, a cloud of mosquitoes and flies just swarms up. I mean, it's inexplicable.
And Arwa, Israel has in recent days said that it's opening up new entry points into Gaza for aid. Could you talk about the aid that you saw coming in, which still has not reached the level, the number of trucks per day, before the war even started?
Right. And there's a number of things that I think, you know, everyone would be best served to understand about, you know, aid and distribution. So, yes, if more aid is able to get in, absolutely that is going to help. However, when it comes to getting aid to those who need it, it is beyond just opening up additional crossings. The aid trucks that come into Gaza all get searched by Israel, and that is a process that can take around 2 to 3 weeks to begin with. You do see aid being distributed. The problem is that the quantity of the aid is insufficient. Additionally, it's important to note that once the aid gets inside Gaza, getting it distributed within this, you know, tiny little space, yet at the same time extraordinarily difficult to navigate area, poses great and additional challenges. There's a process that's called deconfliction. This exists in all war zones, whereby which aid organizations wanting to reach a certain area will notify warring parties about their intent and will secure permissions to be able to safely move to that area. This is a process that has not and does not work inside Gaza. And the tragic, horrific strike that we saw on the World Central Kitchen convoy is clear evidence of that. And that really sent huge shockwaves within the humanitarian community, because the World Central Kitchen has some of the best deconfliction mechanisms, has some of the best lines of communication to the Israeli side. And so you have these additional layers upon layers of challenges. Add to all of it, the lack of aid has created a very understandable level of panic among the population. What that means is that whenever aid arrives to a certain area, there is chaos and there is panic. And this is why you keep hearing people speaking about the need to flood the zone. The zone needs to be flooded not only with aid so that people can stop panicking and have a certain measure of confidence that they will be getting a stable supply of food, water, and other basic necessities, but also the zone needs to be flooded with humanitarian workers, people who know how to address this level of a humanitarian crisis.
And could you talk as well about the impact of this war, the mental health impact, especially on the children of Gaza that you have spoken so eloquently about in recent days?
I'll give you one example. a mother came up to me and she was she'd heard about the fact that, you know, we do work with mental health, specifically with children. It's also important to note that, you know, when an area, a population is still in crisis, is still in an emergency, all you can really provide is basic mental health, especially for children. What does that actually look like? It really just looks like a distraction. So creating activities and ways for them to express themselves that can sort of help them distract themselves from all of the horror and the nightmare that they're going through. But this mother comes up to me and she says, I don't know what to do with my 7-year-old right now, because every single night he screams at the top of his lungs and he goes into what look like convulsion and seizures. And he started doing this after he saw his sister's head blown off during a strike that hit their home that also wounded other siblings. You know, you walk around Gaza, and I'm talking specifically about the children right now, but you see this also very deeply in the adults. And you know that sparkle that's normally supposed to exist in a child's eye, it's not there anymore. That's not to say it can't come back and it can't be brought back with these activities. You know, there are these beautiful, heartwarming moments where you are able to create a scenario for a child to be able to, you know, laugh and smile, albeit briefly. But you really feel as if you are walking through a population that is, they're ghosts, and they describe themselves as ghosts. They're ghosts of their past. They're the ghosts of who they used to be, and they're constantly haunted by the ghosts of everything that they have lost. And the trauma doesn't end. It comes at them from multiple different directions every single day. The mental health impact of this is unlike anything that I personally have ever seen 20 years working in war zones. Just the immediacy of the need, the speed with which this all happened. And even people in Gaza, when you talk to them right now, you know, despite having lived through this for 6-7 months, they still tell you that they feel as if, you know, this can't be real, right? Like this can't have happened. This has to be a nightmare from which one day they're going to wake up.
Arwa, you have said, you've pointed out that what's happening in Gaza right now is absolutely egregious, that the Western world, the ones providing the weapons, cannot pressure Israel into allowing more aid and medical staff. Can you talk more about that? I mean, this isn't a natural disaster where, you know, an earthquake happened and people can't get to the people. Explain exactly Israel's role in preventing this aid from getting to those in need.
So nothing goes in and out of Gaza without Israel's approval. Nothing. That includes aid and that includes people. There's a whole process for that. And this is a process that actually existed before October 7th. It is, since October 7th, extraordinarily and excruciatingly long. In addition to that, since 2008, there has been a list of items that are banned entry to Gaza. This list also exists to the West Bank. Now, since October 7th, there have been additional items that are not part of this list that have been rejected. There is no formality to this rejection. We, in the humanitarian space, end up finding out about items being repeatedly rejected, and as such, there's no point of trying to send them in because of repeat rejections. These items range from things like, you know, solar panels to wheelchairs to certain kinds of medicine to sleeping bags in some cases, anything that the Israelis say can be deemed to be dual use. But the problem is that it feels very illogical. And again, there's no formality to it. So you don't know if an item is going to get rejected until you actually try to send it in. Some organizations have even had children's toys be rejected. You know, you try to put together these hygiene kits for families, and the nail clippers in them get rejected. And as such, the entire truck gets completely turned around. And so it's extraordinarily difficult to try to navigate that kind of a situation. And obviously, this creates an even greater and more desperate need inside Gaza itself. Now, what is very difficult to comprehend, as you were saying there, is the fact that Israel is an ally to the United States and other very powerful Western nations. Is this the first time that we've seen an area under siege? Absolutely not. Look, I covered Syria very extensively. The regime of Bashar al-Assad, a dictatorship, along with their Russian allies, did, yes, put entire neighborhoods and areas in Syria under siege. But there we were talking about a dictatorship with Russia as its ally. We saw ISIS besiege entire areas in both Syria and Iraq. But we're talking about ISIS. We're not talking about a democratically elected nation state that is an ally of the United States. And that is what makes it so difficult for anyone inside Gaza to comprehend how it is that the United States is allowing Israel to continue to besiege the Strip in such a way. And remember, it was on day one that Israel cut off electricity, water, and basically vowed to cut off, you know, any form of assistance. They cannot comprehend this. They cannot comprehend how it is that this is being allowed to happen to them, on top of that happening to them, and the United States is still continuing to fund the war effort.
Arwa Damon, I want to ask you about the journalists killed, estimates between 90 and 130, 140 journalists killed by Israel in Gaza alone. You are an award-winning journalist for CNN for 18 years, covered the U.S. attack on Iraq. I wish we saw your reporting more. You mainly did it for CNN International, which would show the picture of the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down in a split screen with the casualties of war, where CNN Domestic would just show the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down hundreds of times. But your reporting was extremely important. I want to talk about seeing the images of casualties on the ground in Gaza. Right now, Israel doesn't allow international journalists in, and domestic journalists in Gaza, so many of them have been killed. Can you talk about the significance of this? Because that leads to people around the world caring to put more pressure.
You know, this is the first time, I would argue, that Gazans have control over the way that their story is being told. And that has made, to a certain degree, the understanding that the Western world has about what's actually happening in Gaza and the toll of all of it shift slightly, because the Western media does not control Gaza's story anymore. Gazans do. I have to say, I mean, I have so much respect and admiration for all of Gaza's journalists, because, you know, when we go into a war zone, wherever it is, as journalists, there comes a point when we get to rotate out, right? You can tap out, you can say, like, I need a break, you know, send in the next crew. They have not been able to tap out for 6 months, and they're not reporting on something that is happening, you know, to a different population. They're reporting on their own people, what's happening to their own families and to their own loved ones. This ongoing effort, however, it would most certainly seem, to try to silence Gaza's journalists is extraordinarily disturbing, but it is sadly part of this whole overarching desire to control the narrative. And right now, though, it's not working, because Gaza's journalists and Gazans, they're not going to stop. And they deserve to be commended for that and for the awareness that they're actually raising about what is happening to them. And it's very, very disturbing, but to a certain degree makes sense from a PR perspective, that Israel is not allowing Western journalists in, because if the scenes that Gazans are witnessing every single day were part of, you know, the regular broadcasts that are happening, there would be a much bigger and stronger outcry than what anything that we're seeing right now. I mean, you know, I went into the European hospital, which is basically southern Gaza's currently largest and only really remaining, you know, significantly functioning hospital. you walk into, you know, the hospital courtyard, the outdoor pathways, and it's streams of tents, and there's sewage lines running next to the tents. And this is inside a hospital. And people have crammed themselves into the hospital corridors themselves. You have bed after bed of injured, and the injured children with amputations, with horrific burns. I walked into the ICU, and there was, you know, a 10-year-old boy, and the ICU nurse said, he's a gunshot victim. He took a gunshot bullet straight to the head. It's just...
We only have about a minute for this segment, but I wanted to ask you, we've mentioned that you were a CNN reporter for 18 years, covered many conflict zones. How do you look at the coverage of CNN since October 7th and the degree to which not only CNN but most Western media outlets are always deferring to Israel to make sure that Israel gets a chance to comment on every single story that they write or that they produce?
You know, October 7th happened and then the coverage began, and I immediately was catapulted back to the post 9/11 era. And I was in New York when 9/11 happened. And my hair stood on end because it was the same level of, you know, dehumanization that we saw back then. It was the same sort of, you know, panicked kind of one-sided to a certain degree reporting that we saw back then. And it was extremely upsetting because one would hope that, you know, the journalism world, the Western journalism space, would have learned the lessons of post 9/11, and that we wouldn't sort of default into this whole dehumanization of the other. And I think it's really important that all journalists are cognizant and should know, you know, we go all over the world. You know, there's a basic fact that we should all know, and that is that, you know, people, we're the same. We love the same. We laugh the same. We live the same. We feel pain in the same way. And yet there was this default back into this dehumanizing rhetoric, this sort of us against them issue. And it was absolutely devastating and gutting and heartbreaking to witness and see that, you know, we defaulted back into sort of that same rhetoric and that same, you know, dehumanization of a population that perhaps, you know, for very superficial reasons, we don't perceive as being like us. And this desire to sort of inflict collective punishment on an entire people.
Arwa Damon, I want to thank you for being with us. Just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza, award-winning journalist with CNN, but now founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children. Also non-resident senior fellow at Atlantic Council. Spent 18 years at CNN as a senior international correspondent. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue on Gaza, lawyers representing Germany at the International Court of Justice delivered their concluding remarks at The Hague today in a case brought by Nicaragua, which has accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide in Gaza by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Nicaragua has asked the UN's top court for emergency measures, ordering the German government to halt its support to Israel. Germany is Israel's second-largest arms supplier after the U.S. In 2023, Germany approved arms exports to Israel valued at over $353 million, roughly 10 times the sum approved the previous year. For more, we're joined by Kenneth Roth, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as the executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's joining us now in New York. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ken. It's great to have you with us. Can you explain why Nicaragua is simply taking on Germany and the significance of this case, another case being brought to the UN's top court?
Obviously, the United States would have been the ideal target. The U.S. is the principal armor of the Israeli military. But the U.S. has a much more limited acceptance of the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. It basically has to consent to every suit, and it was not going to consent to this suit. Germany has a much more open-ended acceptance of the jurisdiction. So Germany, being the second largest armor of the Israeli military, it was the target. Now, in terms of the significance, the court has already found that this is a plausible case of genocide. And Nicaragua is saying, Germany, you are arming potential genocide. They also have added that Germany is arming actual war crimes, violations of international humanitarian law, which it clearly is. Now, there is a precedent for this. If you remember back to Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, he was convicted of aiding and abetting war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone and is actually currently serving a 50-year prison term in Britain for that crime. So the International Court of Justice is a civil court. It's not a criminal court. But Nicaragua is basically pursuing the same theory, saying, you know, this is at least war crimes. It's plausible genocide. You're arming it. That's aiding and abetting. You should stop. That's the essence of the case.
I wanted to ask you, Kenneth, there were 40 Democratic members of Congress, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who have written to President Biden urging him to halt new arms transfers to Israel in the wake of the killing of the World Central Kitchen aid workers. What's your sense of the prospects for possibly halting or at least significantly reducing U.S. arms shipments to Israel?
Well, you know, one, that has been the line that Joe Biden has been unwilling to cross. He has spoken at this point quite eloquently, pushing Israel to stop bombing civilians, to allow more food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But these, from Netanyahu's perspective, are just empty words because Joe Biden never backs them up with consequences. And the obvious consequence, the obvious huge leverage that the U.S. government has, is the $3.8 billion in annual military aid it gives Israel and the regular shipment of arms, you know, almost every week in the course of this conflict. And Biden has not been willing to explicitly condition that aid, those arms sales, on ending the bombing and starving of Palestinian civilians. Now, we heard last week that in the private phone call with Netanyahu, Biden suggested that at some point in the future, this might be conditioned, you know, that U.S. relations will depend on how Israel responds. But it was all very vague. And of course, Netanyahu responded with equal vagueness. He says, okay, at some point, I'll open up the new crossing into northern Gaza to allow more food aid in, but that'll take a few weeks, and I'm not saying anything about whether I'll impose the same kind of obstructions in the north as I've imposed in the south, and I won't say anything about, you know, Israel's shooting at Palestinian police officers so that there's chaos when you try to distribute the food. You know, none of that is on the table. So, in essence, Biden is not using this huge leverage, despite the pleas of an increasing number of lawmakers in Washington, you know, despite rapidly changing U.S. opinion polls saying Americans are tired of the U.S. actively supporting these war crimes, this plausible genocide in Gaza.
Why is he doing this? I mean, it is amazing to see the split in the Democratic establishment. I'm not just talking about the protesters on the streets who definitely are driving this split. But, you know, you have now Senator Warren of Massachusetts saying she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. You have Christopher Coons, who I consider a Biden whisperer, who is now talking about halting weapons sales to Israel. But you have Biden resisting, though he has talked about a ceasefire. Why is this so difficult for him? What do you think it would take, especially now that you have Netanyahu saying that he set the date certain for invasion of Rafah?
He just won't tell us what that date is, yes. Amy, that's the big psychoanalytic question, and we just don't know. I mean, part of it, I think, is that Joe Biden, you know, who is an older man, as we know, you know, thinks of Israel back in 1967. When it was the Davids surrounded by the Goliath of all the Arab states attacking Israel. He doesn't think of Israel today, the regional superpower, a nuclear-armed state, a state that has been occupying Palestinian territory for decades and is imposing apartheid. You know, that's just not in his mind. More to the point, he seems to be making a political calculation, and he's always, you know, been focused on the movable middle, the handful of independent voters who could go either way in the six swing states. And what he seems to be discounting is the progressives. And clearly the Michigan primary was a bit of a wake-up call. Suddenly the large number of uncommitted votes in a swing state. And so we've seen him being more attentive, but I think he still calculates that progressives have no place to go. They're not going to vote for Trump, and abstaining is effectively a vote for Trump. So when push comes to shove in November, they're going to have to hold their nose and vote for Biden. And that seems to be what is pushing him at this stage.
Well, Ken Roth, I want to ask you to stay with us as we continue our discussion about U.S.'s foreign policy, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as executive director of Human Rights Watch. When we come back, Rwanda marks 30 years after the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor, and we'll look with Ken Roth at how the U.S., France, and other nations stood by, refusing to say the word genocide, afraid it would trigger force the use of the genocide conventions. Stay with us. Back in 20 seconds. Urupfu nicyo kibi kiruta ibindi. Urupfu nicyo kibi kiruta ibindi. Ariko rutubera inzira. Chibi chiru tibindi urupfu ni chachibi chiru tibindi ariko. The Meaning of Death by the Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo, a survivor of the 1994 genocide. In 2020, he was found dead in a cell in Rwanda after being arrested days earlier. The song was released a decade ago, banned in Rwanda. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Rwanda is holding a week of commemorations marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, when up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias. During the genocide, at least 250,000 women were raped. As the world watched the horror unfold 30 years ago, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refused to help stop the killing. The Rwandan President Paul Kagame said in a speech Sunday, the international community, quote, failed all of us. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton traveled to Rwanda this week to mark the 30th anniversary of the genocide, along with other foreign dignitaries. As President Clinton refused to label the 1994 mass killings in Rwanda's genocide, he has since said his failure to respond was one of his biggest regrets of his presidency. This is President Clinton speaking in 1998.
We did not immediately call these crimes by their rightful name, genocide. We cannot change the past, but we can and must do everything in our power to help you build a future without fear.
In 2021, French President Emmanuel Macron acknowledged France's role in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide. The anniversary of the genocide comes at a time when Rwanda's longtime president, Paul Kagame, is coming under increasing criticism for his autocratic rule. To talk more about Rwanda 30 years after the genocide, we're joined by two guests. Still with us, Ken Roth served for nearly three decades as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And joining us from Sydney, Australia, is Noel Zehabamwe, the founder and chairperson of the African-Australian Advocacy Center. Both his parents were killed during the genocide. He's co-author of the book 1,000 Hills. Noel, thank you so much for being with us. Talk about what happened 30 years ago and ultimately why you had to leave Rwanda many years later. What happened to your parents?
First and foremost, let me start by thanking you for hosting me, Emery. 30 years ago, my country of birth descended into darkness and the pain of genocide. And I remember very well when I was with my parents and my younger sister, and I recall my daddy telling me that we see each other in heaven. That's the last word I heard from my father, and since then, we never met again. That's what happened 30 years ago in April, when this darkness descended into a wonderful country, which is 1,000 hills. And as I can say, I tragically not only lost my parents, I also lost immediate and extended family members.
And can you talk about the role of the genocide in shaping how the international community looked at President Kagame's leadership? He was portrayed as a hero who ended the genocide.
It's very important to understand that everyone should see that the genocide was coming. And I agree with you saying that the international community has failed to save or to help Rwanda from descending into that tragedy. However, in 1994, I remember very well that there was a way that international community was going to stop the genocide, but they ended up not doing so. Like many victims, many Tutsis were being targeted, killed, and also, of course, as we said, many Hutus as well, and also Twa and the foreigners. There's no doubt that all those victims were being killed, and the international community was standing by. So, however, when genocide ended in July, we all hoped that the country was going to be rebuilding itself. And also, many people, especially survivors, we thought that the Rwanda was going to be, again, a Rwanda we used to know when we were kids, like a Rwanda of 1,000 hills. However, we started noticing that what we thought was going to be a country of peace, a country of harmony, we could see that there was the current ring regime, those other atrocities committed, actually targeting also the Hutus as well. So from April to July, Tutsis were mainly targeted, killed because they were Tutsis. And also when the government took over the current regime, we thought that storm was over, but we could see also there was other atrocities from RPF side. So what happened now? As I was a child, I remember I fled to Burundi, and then I came back in September. I went to orphanage center. That's where I spent my teenagerhood. When I finished high school, I went to university. When I started university, I started being approached, being coerced to join the current regime, which I refused because I didn't want to join the politics, because one of the main problems Rwanda has always have is poor leadership. The leaders Rwanda has ever had, they don't look into big picture. They always look into narrow into those kind of I can say their own interest rather than looking into public, to general interest. So then when I was the first many times to join the Ringi Party, I was told that even though when you finish university, you may not get a job, you may even not get there. And then I continue, you know, being chased away, and then I end up becoming again a refugee. Then I went to Kenya, I came to Australia. Coming to Australia, I started building my life from scratch, and then when I had my family, I became a community leader here. After becoming a community leader, I was approached by ambassador who was based in Singapore to work for them again, and then which I refused because I said I can't do that kind of a job. And then the price I was given, my two brothers, 5 years ago, on the 28th of September, were during the day removed from the bus. Since then, they have never been found again. despite having credible evidences, with the driver who was driving the bus and the passengers who have seen my brothers being removed from the bus, when I started claiming, asking for the government for help, the government refused to help me. Instead, they started tarnishing my image in the media that I'm lying, that I'm in opposition. So that's the kind of image many victims like me have. So being a victim of a genocide, once again, so being a victim of the regime that came to power, promising us to live in harmony and peace.
Noel, I wanted to talk about what's happening today with Paul Kagame's Rwanda. But I want to stay in 1994 for a moment, when the United States government carefully avoided using the word genocide to describe what was happening in Rwanda. This is a clip from PBS Frontline documentary Ghosts of Rwanda, beginning with a State Department briefing, April 28, 1994.
Comment on that, or a view as to whether or not what is happening could be genocide.
Well, as I think you know, the use of the term genocide has a very precise legal meaning, although it's not strictly a legal determination. There are other factors in there as well. When in looking at a situation to make a determination about that, before we begin to use that term, we have to know as much as possible about the facts of the situation.
Out of curiosity, given that so many people say that there is genocide underway or something that strongly resembles it, why wouldn't this convention be involved?
Well, I think, as you know, this becomes a legal definitional thing, unfortunately, in terms of as horrendous as all these things are, there becomes a definitional question.
That was Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, speaking in 1994. Ken Roth, you were Human Rights Watch executive director at the time. We don't have much time, but explain what the U.S. didn't do.
Well, first of all, these word games with genocide were because there was a perceived obligation that if there is genocide, you have to suppress it. You have to act. And so they said, oh, it's maybe acts of genocide, which they thought meant something lesser. Now, this was the moment, it's hard to think back, but this was before Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. It was an era where Americans were very unused to the idea of American military casualties abroad. And Clinton was just not going to risk it further after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. So he was determined not to send in troops. It's important to recognize that the Rwandan genocide was carried out by a rudimentary force, basically using hate radio, the infamous Radio Milkoline, to rally people with machetes to kill their neighbors. And Alison DeForge, my colleague at the time, who was really one of the world's experts on Rwanda, was convinced that two forces could have stopped the genocide: the UN peacekeepers, UNAMIR, and a French evacuation force that was sent in. But the French evacuation force evacuated the Westerners and left Rwandans to their fate. The UN Security Council, at U.S. urging, reduced the number of peacekeepers from 2,500 to 250 and never gave them a protective mandate. And so as a result, the genocide unfolded. And when Clinton, you know, apologizes today, it's because he did nothing to stop the genocide. Indeed, I remember we were meeting with Anthony Lake, the national security advisor of Clinton at the time, and he said, make more noise. In other words, we're not going to stop the genocide as a legal duty. We're not going to stop the genocide because we have a moral responsibility to do that. We're only going to stop it if there's no political cost, if the American people are demanding this of us. That was the complete abdication of moral responsibility of the Clinton administration.
And Ken, we only have about a minute left, but what parallels do you see with how the U.S. Acted or didn't act back then to the war we're facing right now with on the part of Israel in Gaza?
Well, Juan, interestingly, it would be easier for the U.S. to act today. In other words, in the case of the arms sales end tomorrow.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And by the way, I want to say that at the time, 1994, Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then became Secretary of State. I want to thank Ken Roth, who is former executive director of Human Rights Watch for for close to 30 years, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And I want to thank Noel Zahabamwe, who is founder and chair of the African Australian Advocacy Center, speaking to us from Australia, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to remind you that everything that's said today on the program is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members, and strictly the views of myself. So welcome. Welcome to The Angry Young Man, that wonderful, amazing time of the week, depending on whether or not it's a Tuesday or a Thursday. Welcome, and that statement might not make sense right now, but this does re-air on Tuesdays, so hello, Tuesday people. You're in the future. Now, I was supposed to have a guest today. Said guest has played hooky. It's okay. You know, I don't blame them. It's beautiful outside for the first day in a couple days. I mean, you don't have to look too far outside the window to see that it's sunny and, you know, at least a little warm. I'm glad it's not, you know, torrential downpour like what ended up. I don't know if any of you saw the point flooded. Then those the poor people that mulched PNC Park. Just have to go and probably redo that. But I digress. Anyways, so given the fact that this is no longer going to be the discussion that we were going to have, going to be doing something a little different. See, I'm an economics student, and economics is a kind of passion area for me. Definitely enjoy talking about the wonderful, fun world of economics, and that doesn't, you know. Some very pertinent stuff to speak about as it relates to the issue of economic policy currently in the United States. Particularly, you look at the issue of current spending at the federal level and the inflationary result of it. So kind of want to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to speak a little bit about, you know, well, and I'll get into this a little bit, with inflation and massive spending comes the devaluation of the U.S. dollar, which makes it a less attractive method of spending or saving. Where some people have looked to replace that then with investment in either precious metals like gold or silver, and some have gone to digital currencies. Many have decided to go that way, inclusive of our federal government, looking to create a central bank digital currency. I'm talking a little bit about the inherent issues with the central bank digital currency, and why we should be afraid of it, potentially, or concerned at the very least. Not necessarily afraid, but maybe concerned at the outset. Definitely some scary things in there, but also then finally kind of wrapping around talking about how this all goes back to the grander issue of banking, not just central banking, but banking on the whole. So if this all kind of resonates with you, stay tuned. But if it doesn't resonate with you, I believe that this is something that you could listen to. It would be fun to listen to, potentially. Keep an open ear. See what we have going on. But before we do launch into that, also just letting you know that WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches and breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email PR at WRCT for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Also, just a couple shows here on WRCT. We have From Here to Eternity. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airwaves of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back